part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
Fanboy.com. How are you, sir?
I'm okay, man. I'm just really excited to talk to you.
No, yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, I know that we only had, it was like 5 hours there that one day, but I don't know. Like I said, whenever I, you know, it was a tough time in LA. So like whenever I met people that were really nice, it like left a lasting impression on me.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated that you were just, I mean, like, it was funny. I was like, all I did was like ask for a pencil. And then all of a sudden it was just like, there was a conversation there, you know?
Yeah.
And then, so yeah, anyway, thank you so much for like being kind.
Oh no. Well, thank you for being kind. I mean, we were booth mates at, I think it was like the East LA Comic Con when that was like a thing.
Yeah.
I don't think it is anymore, right?
Well, I talked to Pete Malini, and I always get his last name wrong. So sorry, Pete. But I'm actually going to a store next week. So I'll be in LA.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and he told me that something about how he had to pause it, and then something might happen in the near future. So I just said, hey, let me know when that happens.
Cool. No, that's great. So I should let people know right off the start that we had a little bit of trouble like setting up the recording studio. You may get the reflection of my voice on Steven's end, but it's fine. I'm going to work around it. Hopefully I can edit it out. We've had worse things happen on this podcast. Trust me. So, but just in case people realize like, hey, Christian's voice is being reflected back at him. It's just that you'll have to deal with it, but that should not keep you from supporting Steven's project, which is that we should say that your name is Steven Yu, correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And your project is Joan, and it is currently on Indiegogo, right?
Yes.
And you funded, right? So you're funding, and we want more money. We want more money. Just throw more money.
Yeah. That's essentially it. Just give me the cap. I am a capitalist, so just give me all that money.
Show
so
me
I can
the money.
Make more money.
Yeah. Money. Yeah. Nice. Okay, cool. Yeah. The project again is Joan, currently on Indiegogo. Your name is Steven Yu. My name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. If you did not notice, like from our sort of friendly banter in the beginning, Steven and I have known each other for a while. We met at the, like I said, the East LA Comic Con, and we were booth mates together. And that was kind of like, it used to be a fun little con before the pandemic. And, we had a good time like chatting with each other and just hanging out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I always liked you, and you're so funny because you say that I was kind to you, and I was like, I really liked your artwork, and I really, you know, I enjoyed hanging out with you and chatting with you, and you were nice enough to compliment my artwork, which, you know, I'm one of those self-loathing artists. Like I hate everything I do. So like for somebody like of your talent to be like, hey man, like I think I did like my first Super Naruto drawing like sketch.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's really good. And I was like, thank you so much. And, yeah, I eventually did kind of a print of that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, which you can find of, not that drawing, but that idea. And you can find that on the shop link on Part-Time Fanboy. But we're not here to talk about my stuff. We are here to talk about your stuff, which Joan, again. So let's get started. Obviously, you are a Sergio Leone fan, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I love his stuff. It's awesome.
Yeah, me too. I'm a huge, massive Sergio Leone fan. Like I've seen several of them on the big screen, you live in LA.
Oh, awesome.
You're fortunate enough to like see. I think I saw Once Upon a Time in the West at the Cinerama Dome when that was around.
Oh, sick.
Yeah. And
oh,
it was
awesome.
Blew my mind. It was the first time I'd ever seen it. So I was just like, oh my God, just destroyed me. And let's let people know what Joan is about, because obviously we've said Sergio Leone influence, there's a John Woo influence, there's Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, it's all kind of like mixed in here, but it is Joan, and what is your book about?
So the pitch I usually do is I say it's basically a medieval martial arts Western take on Joan of Arc, and The character herself talks in Tarantino isms. So if you understand Tarantino movies, you understand the rhythm of, you know, the cadence of how the dialogues are spoken.
Yeah.
But the heart of it, the story is about an authoritarian king named King Henry, and him and his loyal sorcerer, mage like warriors, they are spreading their might and will across Europe. Like wildfire. And so God resurrects Joan of Arc, gives her immortality and infinite modern military weapons, ammos to stop them. It's a revenge story, but that's really just more of kind of what I talk about. It's kind of more of a, what do you call it? Like it's the decoration. It's kind of like, okay, here's the popcorn factor. But the heart of it is more of my journey as a creative person. Mm-hmm. And it's reflected in Joan, because her story is about how she herself was sent on missions, told to support these campaigns by holy men and corrupt monarchs, but she never really had a chance to realize who she was and what her real mission was. And that's how I felt, honestly, when I was in LA. And the past decade or more, it has been just me kind of just going towards a direction that I think is successful, because either well-intentioned, but I think misguided family and friends have told me to go down. And like I would go down certain careers and it just didn't work for me.
Oh, and, interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess the cautionary tale, maybe, or the at least the theme is, what you think you're supposed to do, you can try and go towards that direction, but it may not be what you really want to do. And the whole thing is about exploring that option.
Oh, nice. So
I'm very grateful for all the opportunities, the jobs I've had. But this time with Joan, and I remember I was on Just Joshing, and I remember Josh Pendoresco. I always screw up his last name, but he's awesome. It was really insightful. He said, okay, basically what it sounds like is that, because he knew that I had a kickboxing background, he's like, okay, when you go into a ring, you are left on your own. Like, there's really no one that can do anything for you, and you have to like fight against something. And what it is it's the fight to be authentic. And I go, yeah, that's what it is. And Joan is that. Joan is me at my most purest, like my storytelling at my most purest, because that's really what I'm trying to do, is tell my own story my own way without the interference of whatever is mainstream logic. You know, you hear, don't make your villains one-dimensional, don't make your villains you know, so and so, but for me, no, this is like I gotta tell in my way.
Yeah,
so the villain is one-dimensional because it's a symbol, it's a theme of something greater that I'm trying to address. And Joan is told in an action story format, because that is what I know. So
yeah. Well, I mean, you were kind enough to share the first two chapters, and I've actually, you know, thrown some money at the Indiegogo, just because like I remember this was like years ago. I mean, you were starting this and you had this at the, at the East LA Comic Con. And I don't even remember. I mean, it was pre-pandemic, maybe like a year or two before that. So we haven't seen each other or spoken in like 7 years or something like that. But I remember you, and I remembered the book, because I was like, oh, Joan of Arc. And I grew up Catholic. I'm pretty much agnostic these days, but obviously I know my sort of like, you know, the saints and the biblical lore and like all that stuff, because it was hammered into me for like 8 years growing up, and, you know, from first to eighth grade. And I guess like one of my first questions to you is, why Joan of Arc? Because you've been, I mean, I follow you on Instagram. I've seen you on social media, and you've been consistent with this. Like, you've been like kind of like with me in the Periwinkle Puss, which is my comic, where it's like, you know, I've been trying to work on it. For years and years, and it's just for me, it's more like trying to find free time to do it, right? Because comics can take, especially if you're doing everything, it takes a lot. Like, it can take a lot of your time and energy, and if you've got a family or whatever else, like, those are my excuses that I feed to myself to feel better, folks. but like, for you, you started this, like, I want to say, or probably previous to, like, 8 years ago. So what is it about Joan of Arc, like, the mythology kind of, like, surrounding that actual history that, like, really stuck with you? Like, what was it that you were like, Joan of Arc, and I want to make it kind of like a John Woo anime manga kind of like style comic book that you've hung on to for all these years to get out, and now finally it's like, you know, on Indiegogo and you're getting it done?
So first off, I don't think, you know, it's funny, people have asked me this, like, why Joan of Arc?
Yeah.
And I'm definitely not a pious man at all. Like, I have no, I'm agnostic, you know, just like you.
Me too.
And,
yeah.
You know, and it actually wasn't about Joan of Arc in the beginning. Mm-hmm. What it was is, I had so many failed attempts at making something of myself. And I remember the last straw was applying for an internship at the ADG. Uh-huh. And at that time I was just like, oh, I want to be an art director. Okay, I'm going to try this, you know? And the thing is that, again, this is part of that journey of me trying to figure things out, because I remember, you know, I had people telling me, oh, you'd be perfect doing this. And I'd be like, oh, okay, I'll give it a try. Like, I don't know anything from anything. I'm just kind of like, all right, I'm just going to try it because someone told me I had to try it, you know?
Yeah.
And then, so anyway, I got a rejection and I was like, okay, that's like, 20th one, all within, like, you know, the past like year.
Yeah.
I'm like, either I'm not good or I'm just not doing what people want and need.
Yeah.
And then the question is, what do I want to do? And I was like, all right, I'm going to try to make a film. And, you know, I always hear a lot of comic book creators going, well, I started out trying to make a film. And I was like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Right. I think, and my apologies, I don't remember his name, but the guy that wrote the Bigfoot,
there have been a couple of Bigfoot ones on this, could be several, Zach Howard, I think, might've been one of them. And like,
okay, maybe it was Zach Howard, but, I think he was writing how, Bigfoot was on Mars or something, on a different planet.
Oh no, that's, Bigfoot on Mars. Josh Henneman. Yeah. Josh Henneman.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, that was a podcast a while ago. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I really like that interview that you had.
Oh, thanks.
It's weird, by the way, side note, Henneman, like, I remember looking at his name. Oh, yeah, like Hanuman, like the you know, Indian god. And I was like, wait a minute.
Interesting.
I just all of a sudden forgot. Anyway, irrelevant side note. But anyway, but creators like him, I know they always, frequently they want to start making a film, and then they find out about the comic book medium. They're like, wait, I could do stuff here. So when I wanted to make this film, I wanted to make it like this medieval knight story. And I just thought, okay, that'd be kind of cool because I've never done that before.
Yeah.
And I tried doing my research. I was researching armor and I was just like, okay, this is a lot. And so finally I said to myself, all right, this knight pulls out a sword and the dueling opponent pulls out a M16. And I thought that was like the funniest idea. I was like, this is like, that's weird.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I was like, okay. And the M16 goes off. And it's just splitting this like other knight in half. And I just pictured this very grindhouse esque kind of thing where it's like going on for a minute, like in RoboCop where they're shooting that corporate exec when they hit to him and he's just unloading bullets. And I was like, okay, that's funny. And then I was like, okay, but who's holding the M16? And I was like, well, it's .. Joan of Arc. And I remember laughing, internally. It's just like, what a weird idea.
Yeah.
And I started exploring this weird idea. I'm like, okay, like, where can this go? And eventually I did read up on Joan of Arc and I thought she was interesting because during that time, like 2017, 2016, 2018, I noticed that Conor McGregor, Donald Trump all rose to popularity.
Yeah.
And what I noticed was that these are very cult of personalities. Like, people are drawn to, in the weirdest way, to these very bombastic figures.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, Joan of Arc's story is kind of like that, where it's just this little girl who, 19-year-old girl who says, "Hey, I have the vision of God in me, and I am here to restore France." And it did disrupt a lot of things, to the point where this girl who had no military experience was able to lay siege to an English castle, restore the prince to his throne in Orleans in France. And it was like, wait, what? What is happening? And I think I'm a little drawn to rebellion, revolution, all these like weird, tumultuous, chaotic moments in history. And I thought, okay, the angst I'm feeling, the anger I'm feeling, where I feel like I have no purpose, I feel like I'm lost, I'm drifting, that like made me upset. And I was like, this is it. It's channeled into this book. Just this, the whatever I'm feeling right now, it's just I have to unleash it in this format. And the comic book format is perfect for it. So
That's it. So just to clarify too, I mean, I am anti-Drump. I don't even won't even say his name. I mean,
oh,
we're not equating Joan of Arc with what Donald Trump is doing
yes,
like right now, right? Okay. I just you know, because I mean, the thing about like with Joan of Arc, and you know, you do whatever you want to do, but I feel like we're sort of at this crisis moment in our country where it's like you're either kind of like things have become like very stark, where it's like you're kind of either on this side or this side. And I know that there's rhetoric on both sides, but there's one side that's like, hey, pro my own, like, you know, Latinx, you know, and my LGBTQ and all that stuff. And the other side is kind of like wants to go back to a time where it's like, yeah, none of that. And so, and it just seems very stark. But like with the Joan of Arc thing, and the reason that I feel like that history works very much with your book, especially with her sort of like being resurrected, is it really is like somebody got fucked over like big time, like you know what I mean? Like that is the tragedy of Joan of Arc, and kind of like I remember seeing like Luc Besson's movie The Messenger in the theater, and people hated that movie, and for some reason I loved it when I saw it in the theater. So you know, maybe my tastes just suck. And having seen parts of like other movies that, you know, like The Passion of Joan of Arc and like those old black and white things, you know, it very much goes into that narrative of like, wow, this person stood up to save their country and actually kind of got there and then got fucked over, like because the powers that be were like too scared of them, right? Like, and that to me is very different than kind of like what's happening right now. And you can disagree with me if you want, but I think that that's kind of why it works in this very much like, you know, John Woo, Quentin Tarantino, you know, hard boiled narrative, right? Like, I mean, it plays into it really well, right?
And just to also clarify too, is that what I'm stating specifically is how tumultuous that 1430 AD is in and how 2024 is also tumultuous too. You know, and I think that to me is, and then you have characters who like the villain in Joan is very much a self-righteous authoritarian dictator. And the message I'm trying to communicate too is that I think over the years I've seen a lot of people, there's this level of self-righteousness that has like developed over the years, and to the point if you say, well, okay, but hold on a second, like I don't think that applies to me, it's like you feel this wall of like, oh, okay, I guess I have to agree. So and again, you know, like everyone has their own politics behind that, but I'm talking about more for me as like a creative person. It feels like there is a blueprint template. And, you know, again, I'm trying to move away from like the politics to talk more about the creative realm. I feel like here's something I want to do, and I hear all the time, don't do it because of X, Y, and Z reasons. And all of a sudden, it's your autonomy to explore what's right, wrong, to explore what's successful and what could be a failure. It's taken away from you because other people feel like they've done it before, and then they realize that it's hard, so you shouldn't do it. And to me, that's always been a huge injustice.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what I'm trying to get to. And I just feel like, you know, this could be a story. This is where like the heroes and villains come in.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I think what you're kind of talking about, and you know, it's something that I experienced in my own life as well. And we may have chatted about it like 8 or whatever years mm-hmm. ago, which is, you know, very mm-hmm. much kind of like that artist journey, right? Where it's like, I mean, yeah. you know, between you and me, it's like, I put up a drawing on Instagram and it's like 5 likes, you know? And I'm like, come on, I know yeah. I'm better than right, fucking yeah. 5 likes. Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
And then you hear right. from, I mean, I hear from people like, I love your stuff and I think it's great. And it's like, okay, well, just, I know that you're out there. Like, just, right. so for me, it's like, is the algorithm not serving me or does my stuff just suck?
Right.
Or, like, you know what I'm saying? So, and yeah. so I totally feel you in that. And it can get you like down a lot. Like,
yeah.
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I'm just always real on this podcast and I'm always real with like the people that I meet. It's like, I am very sort of self, like, you know, with my own art, very self-critiquing, very, I will yeah. pull my stuff apart like nobody's business. So, you know right. what I mean? So yeah, like so. When I kind of make comments about other people's art too, it's like, trust me, like I look at my own stuff and I rip it apart, yeah, you know, yeah, as yeah. much. So, I mean, I totally kind of get where you're coming from. And not to sort of get lost in like the artist journey of it all, because I mean, I feel like that's a legit conversation, but let's
yeah.
talk a little bit about the book, because on this podcast, I've mentioned it before. I even mentioned it in my last interview, we talk about personal things and mm-hmm. what the book is about gets a little bit lost. And I don't want that for you. I want people to throw money sure. at your project because I very sure, much sure. enjoyed reading it. So let's go into like Joan is about Joan of Arc. And
yeah.
she gets sacrificed and then she comes back. But this book is a little different in that, like you said, it takes place in kind of that era of time, but there's actual magic and there's actual machine guns
right.
and there's actual like stuff like that. Can you talk about that aspect of the book a little bit?
Yeah. So I got one hate letter.
You did?
Yeah.
What?
Someone said, this is...
Are you serious?
Someone wrote, I'm not going to read this book because there's no way Joan of Arc has guns.
Oh,
and I think
God.
I wrote something back like, well, you're wrong because I was there and I saw it. So,
yeah. That's great. That's great.
Yeah, so I wanted this story to feel like, you know, it's a weird mixture of fantasy, action, Western, you know, and I was thinking, okay, this weird idea that I came up with years ago when, you know, it was like that almost kind of like a medieval duel between two knights and then one pulls out the M16. I thought, okay, what can I build around that? So I started to think, okay, is it literally she has guns? What is going on here? And I created this idea of these magic sorcerers who are, okay, in real history, the Burgundians were these loyalists to the English monarch.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, there's something there. You have these weird, interesting political heads. And I was like, what if they were sorcerers? And I was like, okay. So I made it sorcerers. I was like, okay, now we have magic in this world. And then I thought, okay, Joan of Arc's guns, what are they? And I thought, no, you know what? They're also another form of magic.
Mm-hmm.
So to the viewers or the readers, we're looking at it as, oh, okay, it's guns. Actually, it's her version of magic. So the official name for her power is called Deus Ignis Canonin, which is God's firepower. And yeah, so God says to her, I am going to imbue you with part of my fire, my will. So when he gives it to her, that's her ammo. So well, if we were there, if we existed in the universe of Joan's world, it might look different. That's why they look at her as a witch, because they don't understand what that firepower is.
Yeah.
But when she interacts with the other sorcerers, they know exactly what that is.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the lore, the technicals behind the world building.
Got it. Like that's such a great way of looking at it and kind of like thinking of it, like that the gun in that time period is more magic or it's more kind of fantastical, or like instead of like what I saw it as, you know, and maybe anyone who kind of like would pick up this book, and that person who got upset with you, which is like absolutely ridiculous, because like as you open the book, it's like Joan of Arc got fucked over and then she's brought back to life. Like it's like, what are you, like, that didn't happen. Like, this is, you know, fantasy. But like, I think that the way that you're kind of explaining it to me, and I don't know if I missed it when I was reading it in the book, but I think that's a really cool way, because I was like, okay, she's got guns and she's shooting at people. And I'm like, but the guy's got a sword, and then they have magic and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, it really plays out. It's very cool and like interesting and different, and not like anything I've really seen before. I mean, there's one Korean manga called Priest, which I don't know if you've ever heard of. That your style reminds me a little bit of, but I don't think that I've ever really seen anything like this, or can recall anything like this, where it's like swordplay and magic and guns and grenades and all that crazy stuff mixed into one. And I was like, somehow you made it work really well.
That was tough, because I did think a lot to I would talk to friends, and especially specifically on volume two, I'm working with my friend Robert Romeo, who's a great comic book editor. He has this background in film writing, film directing, and he's always writing me like essays of thoughts, and he'll be like, wait a minute, great person to spot continuities too. He would be like, okay, wait, but this thing though, how would it work if she has this? And I'm like, oh, okay. So I have to go back and like change up a lot of things. But I always think about the fact that Joan she's immortal and she has modern military weapons in this weird anachronistic medieval era. So how, I can't make her too overpowered. So I started thinking about like what is her challenge? And that was like the biggest thing when I was working with Robert. It was like, what is her deal? You know, what is her weakness? Because we got to get to that at some point, you know, and Volume 2 starts to open it up. But you'll see the villains are not to be trifled with. So one of the most dangerous things about these villains is that they are self-righteous. And I thought about this a lot. I was like, okay, there are villains in cinematic history and comic book history. And it's like, what makes them threatening? And I thought about it. I was like, okay, Darth Vader wavered. That's why he ended up becoming this like anti-hero, and we love him for it.
Yeah.
We look at RoboCop's Clarence Boddicker, but he was just corrupt. And I thought about Thanos, and I was like, what is it that makes Thanos? It just so, I don't know, like this monolith of complexity. And I was like, oh, it's because he's actually very simple. Yes, he's unwavering, but he's also self-righteous. That's the problem.
Yeah, but can I interrupt you for a second? But then Joan kind of considered self-righteous in a way? Like, absolutely. In her?
Yes, yes, okay, absolutely. Okay. And that is what Volume 2 explores.
See, got it.
Sorry. I front-loaded this interview with a bunch of my own like personal experiences.
No.
So now this book is starting to like unfold, so as we're talking about it. Yeah. So, you know, Joan's whole thing is that prior to her death, there was a lot of zealotry, so to speak. So there was a lot of, you know, holy men propping her up, a lot of kings propping her up, and whatever the original intent was to go do something, which was freeing France, make sure everyone is okay, make sure her country is, you know, free from all this oppression, it got lost in the celebritydom. So in Volume 1, QT Bandapart, which if anyone knows that Easter egg, congratulations, that's awesome. But
yeah. You've got Bandapart, a little bit Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez mixed in here. Yeah. As characters. Yeah.
Yeah. So Bandapart, you know, after giving Bandapart back his throne, wiping out the English from that part of the country, Bandapart is like, he's this weird amalgam of film producer, music producer, and king or prince. So anyway, he starts this campaign to make Joan this like badass, like celebrity icon.
Yeah.
And so the story is about, you know, just how that backstory is about how, you know, he like, you know, did a lot for her. And it got to her head, and they started calling her the Saint. And she's like, "Yeah, yeah, I'm the Saint." And all of a sudden, it was just like the group of friends that she grew up with that mm-hmm. are part of her, you know, little band slash rebellion group. They start to go, "Okay, wait a minute, hang on. Are you sure we're supposed to do these things? Like, it doesn't sound like what our natural, like what our original mission was supposed to be." And it just really goes to her head. So the problem with her is that when her friends and her were all tortured and murdered, and now she's back, that is what haunts her. Yeah. Is that, oh, I was like the zealot. There's nothing behind what it is. I didn't have any conviction.
Yeah.
And so now that she's back, it's all this rage and anger, but you'll start to see that it's not working. That's not working either. Oh, because right, because you're facing this giant wall of villainy that is embodied with self-righteousness. It's just how do you fight against that?
Yeah,
and that is what I will get to like later. So
yeah, that's great. I mean, the one thing that I wanted to, you know, kind of like about villainy, right, is like you mentioned Darth Vader and Thanos and things like that, and I think that the reason that people kind of like identify or like get like where Thanos or maybe Vader are coming from is because I have this big thing about storytelling, like, and I'm very much like, if you're gonna have a villain, you gotta make your villain as terrible as possible so that you can just, particularly in a revenge sort of thing or a thing like the Punisher or something, like you have to show how horrible this person is and what they've done in the most unredeemable, like horrible, possibly gory way, so that people can go fucking get that guy. Like that person is horrible. Like, you know what I mean? Right. Like you got to take that motherfucker out. No if, ands, or but, like, you know what I mean? Like, that's why, like, in the 80s stuff, like Dirty Harry or like Death Wish and stuff, like they worked so well because they preyed on that inner fear of like, oh fuck. Like, I'm going to, now obviously all that shit was racist and, you know, and part of its time. And, you know, it was always the Latino or black person, but like, even in something like that's why the Travolta Punisher movie doesn't work that well, because Travolta's like a joke of a villain. Like, you got to have a villain that is like, oh my God, you need to go medieval on that guy's ass.
Yeah.
And like Vader, you never really see like the awfulness of what he's done. And even like in the prequels, like people, you know, like I'm just always astounded by like the Vader jokes where it's like, oh, you know, the Father's Day gifts that people give, like with Darth Vader, where it's like Darth Vader. And I'm like, you guys, in the prequels, he slaughtered a room of children. Like, he's a child killer. Like that's a real thing. They just didn't show him doing it. If they'd have showed him doing it, you would have never been able to sell another thing, piece of Vader merchandise ever again. You know, if you'd have shown Thanos, everyone dissolves into dust. Like, it's like, yeah, that's horrifying, but it's not, you know, it's not people being carted away in camps or put in cages and separated from their children. Like, you know what I mean? So like, you have to make that villain. And then like with the hero, you have to bring them low, like bring them as low as possible at some point. Like, you know what I mean? So that they can rise, like, you know, and fight that awful villain that you've set up. And part of that bringing them low is, you know, having them, you know, like in Conan the Barbarian, one of my favorite, like, you know, old 80s movies, like you see his family get, he sees his family gets, and he gets sold into slavery. Like, you can't get worse than that. Like, you know what I mean? So that's very much for me, like a big thing about villainy. And whenever I see in a movie, like they've kind of got like a buffoonish villain or like, and you know, you can maybe make the villain sympathetic in their own way. But like, once you go down the route of like, the villain is right, or like maybe the villain's got a point. Sure, but things get dangerous for me there. Like, any thoughts on that? Yeah.
No, I dude, I totally agree with everything you said.
Yeah.
And that's what I have to like carefully skirt around too at the same time, because I know some people are like, well, this villain is like one dimensional. I'm like, I remember Robert and I were talking, Robert's notes were like, do not compromise. Do not make this guy compromise.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he's a piece of shit. Yeah. I'm sorry. I don't know if I can cuss on here, but
I've been cussing. Go for it.
Oh, okay. So I was just like, okay, all right. I am going to be very, very, just unapologetic with this guy. And, you know, when I was referencing, you know, the characters earlier, I was just saying more of just like the, their intention is like, I think they think that they're right.
Yeah.
And so that makes them seem like, oh, they're the good guy. But the problem is, no, but your methods are completely wrong, though. And that's the thing that I wanted to do with the villains. Like, the villain thinks he's right, but we're not seeing what that right is. Because that right is basically, if you're not thinking like me, then we got, then, you know, he thinks, well, we all have a problem then.
Yeah.
And like, you know, how do you interact with someone when they think like that, you know, especially let alone they control the entire freaking country.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, so I thought about that with like Clarence Boddicker. It's like, dude, that guy is like a piece of shit.
Oh yeah.
That guy, he didn't just kill, you know, Alex Murphy, but he took away really his humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then I was just like, no wonder, like, you know, RoboCop went out for revenge and it's just, you know, no wonder he went back to his home and punched that monitor, because he was just like, I remember Paul Verhoeven said something. I think it was either Paul Verhoeven or Peter Weller saying it was the first time RoboCop started to realize what he is, neither human nor flesh, or neither robot nor flesh. And I was like, oh, yeah, that is pretty damn existential. That's a weird thought, you know?
And there's no going back for him, like, right? Like, whatever's been taken away cannot be returned. You know, it almost is like death. Like, you know what I mean? I mean, like, he did die. Yeah. You and I could have a conversation about RoboCop for like 5 hours, as far as I'm concerned. Like, right. I mean, when you were talking about a Boddicker before and you were kind of like, he's just corrupt. And I'm like, oh no, no, that man is a piece of human swill. Like, he is awful, awful human being. And the greatest thing about Boddicker and RoboCop is when he finally gets his kind of comeuppance, or is getting the shit kicked out of him by RoboCop, he's like, wait, you're a cop. Like he doesn't have anything like to go back on. Like, there's nothing protecting him anymore. So he becomes a coward. Like, you know what I mean? And I love that turn where he's just like, you're not supposed to be able to do this. Like, you're a cop. Like, you know what I mean?
He has like nothing left. Yeah.
The first RoboCop is like, I should have you back on and we should just talk. I don't know if we've ever talked about RoboCop on this podcast, but.
Oh, dude, like, I can nerd up. I've seen people write about it. I'm like, no, that's not what they're going for. You know, and I like, try not to be that snob, but hey, I mean, that's what it is.
So let's talk about your influences more. I mean, we segued into RoboCop and stuff. I mean, Samurai Champloo is like one of your sort of, it seems like one of the things that you call out, which I love also the creators of Cowboy Bebop, right? Like, they did that book, they did that anime, excuse me. What are some of the things that, I mean, to me, obviously I've mentioned them before, but like what is the first sort of, like, I guess, John Woo movie that you saw, or Tarantino? Like, how did you get sort of sucked into this genre or style of film that influenced this book?
So really where it started from was, like, I was like 13. Yeah. I had really bad stomach problems when I was a kid. I mean, it was it was bad. It was like, I missed all of eighth grade
because of this. That.
Yeah. It was terrible. And, every night I would wake up, it's like in the middle of the night, and I was like in pain, or I just really just didn't sleep at all. It was pretty bad. And I remember the old VCR / VHS combinations, right?
Yeah.
And I remember I turned on the TV, and there was this, I don't know what channel it was amazing, but they started showing clips of Hong Kong movies. And this was... And for people who are younger, it's like, we didn't have the superhero, you know, franchises back then, right? So it was like gangster dramas, action films. And I remember in the sea of, you know, Harrison Fords, and you have your, you know, Stallones and all that, all of a sudden it was like Asian faces. And I was like, oh, interesting. I knew about Jackie Chan because I was born in Taiwan.
Oh, okay.
And I watched a lot of his stuff. But when I came here, it was like all of a sudden I started watching Lethal Weapons and Die Hards. But then 1994 was like, it was like around 1994. It was a big time in my life, because all of a sudden I got to see Asian heroes.
Yeah.
And I remember Chow Yun Fat holding a revolver, wearing like a bulletproof vest, and it was hard boiled. And I was like, oh, and Tony Leung and him, you know, they get in that standoff. And I was like, oh, this is like really cool looking.
Yeah.
And then Tarantino's face popped, and it was a talking head, and he was talking about the movie. And I go, who's this guy? And actually, I wasn't a big, I was not a big Tarantino fan. You know, I'm still not actually.
Oh, really? For some reason, I love him. I just love him. But anyway, go on.
I like some of the stuff he's created, you know? And I think more I'm in love with his dialogue.
Yeah. Agreed.
But it's also interesting too, because I am interested in stuff that he's interested in terms of like the Hong Kong movies and stuff. So yeah. I think it just became this overlap. So around 2000s, Kill Bill comes out, and I was like, oh, I spot all the influences. And then, you know, it was equilibrium. It was just like, yeah, enough of that dialogue. And then the Hong Kong action stuff that came in.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is really, really cool. And, you know, it made me want to go, okay, what would it look like if John Woo directed a film and Tarantino wrote it? What would that be like? That'd be really freaking cool.
Yeah. I can't imagine that like never happened too. Like that's just, yeah. I almost feel like that's almost like True Romance. Like in a way, like,
Which is funny because in True Romance, Alabama is watching A Better Tomorrow too.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it always like blew my mind why Nick Cage never worked with Tarantino. I always thought, what is that? He'd be perfect in a Tarantino film.
So
as I was developing Joan, I was kind of like, okay, there's the shootouts and stuff, but I was like, no, like, let me take all this stuff that I know, you know, this heroic bloodshed movie, and just let me put it together in this weird medieval story. Cause I think Samurai Champloo did something that I think is amazing, and it should be a genre of its own, the mashup genre.
Yeah.
Because to me, it works on two levels. Number one, obviously on the entertainment level and artistic level, it's really visually appealing and fun to just be immersed in.
Yeah.
But I think the second thing on a deeper level, I really think this is where like culture shine. Because Watanabe was talking about when he made Samurai Champloo, he really wanted to make it like counterculture, and he wanted to just put all these themes in there, all these like things that don't belong together, but he made it fit. And to me, as like a lover of like, you know, just diverse peoples, diverse cultures, I was like, that is like one way where cultures can get along is through the arts. You know, so we like hip hop and samurai, I mean, wow, that's just amazing. And through that, you know, you have Nujabes, and you know, rest in peace Nujabes, but from there lo-fi hip-hop, you know, was invented, and then now you have Shingo too, and Shingo too has been around for a while, but he has like his hip-hop and fusion of like, you know, like jazz and electronica and stuff. It's just really cool, man. I love all that stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm looking at your influences pages in volume one right now, you and I are like simpatico on like so much stuff. I mean, I like other things too, but it's like, you got Tank Girl on there and I'm like, hell yeah. Like Jamie Hewlett, like I love Gorillaz. I love that man's artwork. I actually sent him a message on Instagram like, oh, would you ever be interested like in doing it? And it was like crickets. It was like a long shot. Like there's no way that guy's going to come on my podcast. Like, but I love Tank Girl. Like Tank Girl is like one of those things in the 90s where I was just getting so tired of comics and Hellboy and Tank Girl and stuff that. Milk and Cheese, like just like really like saved my comic collecting habit. Like, you know what I mean? Where I was like ready to give up on it, and Dark Horse and all these other like, you know, stuff like just came in and I was like, oh wow. So yeah, I mean, you and I are like Joan is something that was like made for me where I was like, this guy likes the same things that I like. And it's funny, you know, because I came across the other day, apparently like John Woo is remaking The Killer with like female leads.
Came out.
Did it already come out?
Yeah. So I've been saving that one because
it's on Peacock or something, right?
Well, sorry, the trailer came out.
Yeah, the trailer came out.
Yeah, I've been saving that because
it doesn't look good to me. I don't know.
Okay. Oh, you ruined it for me, man.
No, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it. I just saw the trailer. I was just like, I saw the trailer and I was like, oh, John Woo, what are you, why are you remaking this? It was interesting because my daughter was in the room when I pulled up that trailer, and then I pulled up the original trailer for The Killer, and I was like, oh my God, this is so violent. Like, I was just like, I forgot like how bloody and like gun fueled it was. And I was holy shit. Like, I was like, my daughter's old enough to watch, but I was like, I don't know. Maybe this wouldn't be
seriously. My wife saw the, she saw the ending, a clip of the ending where, the cop and, Alan or Jeffrey, they're just shooting up the, you know, in that church fight.
Yeah, yeah.
And she goes, holy crap, it's super violent. I go,
yeah.
Which
I mean,
not a problem when you're like 14 years old and you're a boy. You're like,
Well, also sort of in that culture of the 80s and 90s where we were living in, where there weren't school shootings like every, like, you know what I mean? Now it's like, it's hard to kind of like watch that as an adult, especially an adult with kids. And you're just sort of like, huh? Like, I mean, I still love it. I cannot, like, the choreography. And even in my thing, the Periwinkle Puss, I have a sticker and a magnet, and the graphic has two doves coming out because I love John Woo so much. I was like, I gotta have doves in there for like the dramatic, you know. And somebody was are these pigeons? And I'm like, no, they're doves. Like, because I love that John Woo stuff. And then when he came to the States, I was just like all those movies I was just not a fan of. I love his Hong Kong stuff, but let's stop talking about John Woo and all that stuff. I want to talk about your art style. Like, are you working traditionally?
Not in the comic. I'm actually working digitally.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Because it looks like brushwork.
Oh, thanks. Well, okay. So prior to working on Joan, I was trying to do that very clean, painterly, you know, concept art house style, you know. And I noticed when I drew on my own, I'm an ink head, you know, it's just forever and always. And when I ink things, they don't look like the way it looks, you know, digitally. So somewhere in 2020 during the pandemic, you know, I remember just like most people that were locked in their homes, I was like, okay, I really don't want to do this. It feels like two different things. So I started using the tablet like I was, you know, using brushes or like pens.
Got it.
And all of a sudden, it just came out this organic style. I'm like, oh, I like this. In fact, I actually treat my digital art like I treat my digital stuff. Where, like, if I make a mistake, no, you just keep going. There's no control Z or any of that. So.
Oh, wow. So you don't undo and stuff like that? That is like, oh my God, that is like my savior. And it also is what keeps me, like, that's interesting because, I mean, I'm sort of coming to a point where it's like, I'm realizing, like, with my art, like, I feel like I get a better result with the tablet, but I enjoy drawing on paper more, and not Bristol and stuff like that. I just love drawing on like sketch paper and stuff and like in sketch pads. And then, so I'm sort of coming to a point where I'm beginning to do stuff or thinking about doing stuff like on sketch paper and then bringing it in to, you know, like Clip Studio Paint and stuff to clean it up, maybe refine it a bit. But I want to get back to that enjoyment of, I mean, I don't, like, as an artist, I've always just loved pencils. Like, I don't think I'm a great inker and stuff like that. Mm. I've never wanted to paint. I just like pencils. I just like drawing in pencil. And I just, you know, so for me, it's really interesting. Everybody's sort of thing, like what they go to as far as like, but I'm sort of like, my comic is taking me years and years to get to. And the whole reason is because I am doing a lot of stuff in Clip Studio Paint and going undo and thinking like, oh, this isn't, you know, this doesn't look good enough or, you know, so it's interesting that that's the way you do it. That must take a lot of willpower, man, for you to just be like, no undo.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I was actually talking to some friends about this. A friend of mine, she got into oil painting she was like, man, it's hard not to like just keep noodling all the time. And with oil painting, with you know, digital painting and all that, I feel like it's more sculpting because you're trying to look for the perfect shape, perfect lines.
Sure.
Whereas I think leaning more towards the Asian ink wash approach, it's like, it's one and done. Like you really just, you can't do it. So that's why I plan it out ahead of time. I grab a piece of paper and I will just go straight into these like gestures, and yeah, they're messy. And but that is honestly how you start to evolve the idea, because I don't know, I've seen people where there are artists who have told me in the past, and they said, you should, you know, it's a very industrial design, which is like you make these clean strokes, you know everything, and you just kind of sit there and you plan it out. I don't have that patience. I'm not that at all. So I have to take this pencil and just scribble until I find what I need, because yeah, there's no way, you know, my brain goes, oh, I know exactly what that shape is. If you can do it, that's great. You know,
yeah.
I don't take away anything, but I can't do that. So I started to just like do these messy gesture drawings. And then by that moment, when I'm done, now I know what I'm doing. So when I go in there and I ink, if I make a mistake, it's okay, because I left room for being able to improv.
Wow. That, I mean, that's really great. It must, like I said, it must take a lot of willpower not to like undo. I mean, I have interviewed, I interviewed a guy once. He does a book called Amulet. And yeah, he was like, I only work in one layer. And I'm like, no, like how? Yeah. Like I'm like, right, impossible. Right. I'm like, there's just no way. I like cannot do that. Like I cannot, I do not have the self-confidence to do that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because like for my art, what I've realized that I do is like you is like, I'm scribbling. And then my drawing is a mess by the time I want to get to the ink, and it's hard to erase all the lines. Like, you know,
yeah,
and for some reason, like with blue pencil, like I can't, like there's something about blue pencil that I just can't get with. Like I have to have like a regular pen. I'm like the Cro-Magnon man, Steven. Like I cannot like advance, but you know, I think that I've leaned on Clip Studio too much, you know, where it's just like, so it's like me trying to find a balance, like of like different stuff, but that's fascinating to me. Wow. You get respect. You get like the snap, the respect, like, respect, you know, snap, like totally. Yeah. Yeah, nice. No,
but like I look at, if you ever look at the works of Yoko Shimizu, I mean, like her and a couple of other comic creators, like Paul Pope, Ashley Wood. Oh, I mean, they're so ink. Yeah. They're like very, like, they're like masters of ink.
Yeah.
And so when I look at that, I'm like, oh, okay. Like I want to try that approach, because there's just, it's weird because it does sound like, wow, you can't make any mistakes, but at the same time, because I always think in dichotomous thoughts, I also think that it's freeing that way too.
Yeah.
Because it's one and done. You get to see it, and it's like, do you like it? Do you not? It's very Buddhist in the sense that if it did, like yesterday, I did this cat, which I thought was gonna look, because I love cats and I have one. I was gonna do this. I was doing this cat that looked like he or she was floating in space, and it had this like Chinese like water flow patterns in the background. Well, it didn't work out, but I was adamant. I was just like, no, this is gonna work, and I'm gonna do it. But it didn't work out, but that's okay. I look at it in a very Buddhist way, and I go, oh, I tried, and then just kind of move on from there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Wow. That's really great. I mean, my family is constantly criticizing me, like, how are you crumpling that up and throwing it away? Or, but it's really interesting, at least for my artistic process. It's funny because I'll do it. Now I've learned, I do a drawing and I don't like it. And then I put it in a drawer. And I just leave it. And then weeks later, I'll go back to it, or like a couple of months. And I'll be like, what the fuck? Like, that was fine. Like, why was I? Yeah. So like when I'm in the moment, I am just like, this is not working. But then I'll go back to it and be like, that was fine. Like, what is that? It is so freaking weird. Like, It's interesting to speak so openly. But I mean, one of the things about art, because it's like, you know, you see so much stuff online and it's like, oh, they're, it looks so perfect and everything like that. And I don't know. I just, I just feel more like talking openly about stuff like this. But I mean, with your art style, that's the amazing thing to me, because it does look loose. It doesn't look necessarily crisp and refined. And how do you achieve that digitally? Are there just special brushes that you're using? Or like, do you just not like put too much pressure on the screen? Like, there must be a discipline to that as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it comes down to again, that Chinese ink wash approach. I was in, so
did you find like special brushes? Oh, what are you working in, Photoshop or like Clip Studio?
Yeah, I use Photoshop and Pals brushes. So I'm basic, man. So there's the dry brush. The dry brush is like my go-to. I learned that in the Chinese ink wash approach, scholars used to do this where they just practice doing calligraphy and then they would like make these like drawings. And I was always looking at Asian, ink wash works. And I was thinking, why is it so simple looking? I mean, some of them can be complex, but for the majority, a lot of the sketches are very simple. There's like, one drawing of a swan or something in the bottom, like right corner of the paper. And then the rest is blank. And I was like, what is that? And I was like, it's all about trying to get that simplicity of the form. And then that's it. Like anything else, you don't want to waste your efforts. That's, what Chinese artists used to think. It was more about getting to the essence of the thing. Everything else was irrelevant. So when I try to draw, I just focus on the shapes that I want. And then the little details, I have to think to myself, are they important or is it more of this self-masturbatory, like, hey, look at what I did, look what I did, And so I didn't want to do that. It's not me. I just don't do that. So I was like, okay, focus on the big shapes. Whatever is irrelevant, it doesn't matter. Black it out or like, like kind of like make it like loose and flowy lines.
Yeah.
And action is that. Action is like, I mean, there's scenes where Joan's like being shot at and she's dodging, arrows and explosive arrows, and she's jumping over like a bar counter. I made it. It was perfect for me because I can draw all this, debris, exploding shards flying. And then, I could focus on the human form in like these like dynamic poses. Yeah. A lot of it is about learning, okay, what's important versus what isn't important. If it's irrelevant, mask it out, shade it, let the lines flow wherever they may. But the most important thing, you have that be crisp and a little more detailed.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool. Like very cool. I mean, I think I am surprised that this is digital. The coloring and everything all that, but I was just like, I'm just to hear that. Like, I'm like, oh wow. And it just must be a discipline in the opposite direction than what I'm doing, which is like, gotta have the line look. Oh, is the circle correct? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So, I mean, I know we're approaching an hour and, I don't want to take up too much of your time because I know time is important, but I kind of wanted to get back to what you were talking about in the beginning of this interview, which is the artistic sort of like your artistic discovery. Like, when we met, you were a storyboard artist, right? And like you were working in storyboards. And I kind of want to delve into a bit more of the, if you've got time, and if not, you can say like, oh, I got to, end the interview or whatever.
Oh, that's fine. Let's go.
But what are the, because that is a thing, right? Like that is like, and it's sometimes a thing that I wrestle with too, which is like, am I supposed to be doing this? What am I supposed to be doing? I'm interested in so many different things. Like I would like to make YouTube videos and I would like to, do podcasts and I would like to make my own comic. What's important? What's not important? Like what's the balance of everything? Like what were you sort of going through when we met and like what was that journey? Was it, and it sounds like you had pressure from like family or friends or something to do things that you didn't want to do. Can you speak openly about that or is it too private?
No, it's fine. I don't mind sharing it. For me personally, it was, and again, I'm always grateful for, whatever opportunities I get. Like I'm always like, there's learning lessons. Like, makes me a better artist.
Sure.
So all those things I'm super grateful of. It's just more of, it comes down to when you're an artist though, you do want to tell your own stories. You do want to visually, create your own worlds. So, I remember and our teacher is always saying stuff like, you got to find your voice. You got to find your voice. And I noticed in the professional realm, it wasn't that at all. Oftentimes it's very much, you got to do the thing, you have a deadline, and it's about getting the project done, you know, which is not wrong. That's exactly what you're supposed to do when you're getting paid to work on something.
Yeah.
You know? But the stuff where you're sitting down and you're going like, okay, what am I really trying to say? It's almost like you're writing an essay. It's like, okay, what are you trying to get to the heart of? What is this about? And that's something that is not, it's just, if you're running a company, I don't know, I like a business, it's you don't, I don't know. I just feel like that takes a lot of time. That's more about soul searching. That's more about like expression of form, expression of art, expression of ideas, you know? So for me, it was like, okay, what am I really trying to do? So here's what happened with the timeline. I go to LA in 2016. I'm working on projects. A lot of times the projects didn't see the light of day. I mean, like 99% of my efforts never became something. I remember I worked on a military action film and I thought, okay, this might be something. Didn't work out. I was like, okay, moved on. And there was a short film that I worked on. It was a cyberpunk with David Yoon called Roam, R-O-A-M. And that was cool. That was like probably one of the hundreds of things I worked on that actually like saw the light of day. And I still collaborate with David Yoon, like, you know, every now and then. And oh, actually, I'm collaborating with him right now on a graphic novel. So anyway, that like worked out. But everything else just seemed like, okay, go this direction because it's successful. I was like, okay. So it was like, I didn't really know what I was doing. And I remember at one point someone telling me, if you keep working on live action storyboards like I was doing, if you keep working on these ads, eventually you'll work on a live action feature length film.
Yeah.
And that, dude, I can honestly tell you, I had no reaction to that. I was just like, oh, should I have a reaction to that? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
And my dad passed away in 2018.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And yeah, thanks, man. And that was like a nightmare because here I was like toiling in LA and just, sometimes I made money, sometimes I didn't. And it got me at the worst time because I had like no jobs at that time. And I was like, uh-oh. So I drive all the way to go see my mom. It was like 10 hours away up north. And just to kind of like, you know, take care of my dad's stuff.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there going, like, okay. And I remember coming back to LA going, okay, let me try again. And it got so bad that I got like a day job, which was fine. But they were suffering from the fact that all their clients were in China and COVID was slowly starting to happen.
Oh, wow.
In China, right? So they were losing their clientele. And I was like, okay. And then so I went, all right. So I went back to freelancing and one studio completely just like screwed me over. And then another client, it was a private, like personal client, he didn't pay me the rest of, you know, what was owed. And I'm sitting there going, what am I doing? And then COVID finally happens in LA. And I was like, all right, I guess I just got to like reboot and restart. And it's been interesting because I've been going down this personal route that has nothing to do with what anyone tells me to do. There's no like, you should go do this, you should go do that. It's more just kind of like, I have very supportive friends now who are like, this is cool, man. What's your plans with this? And I sit there and I go, I don't know. And I'm okay with it. And I just, wow. You know, and then,
yeah.
And then I go, okay, like what makes sense to me? I'll do a convention. Cool. I'll take on freelance. I'll go do a workshop or something. And I don't know. It seems to work out. Nice. So I have to trust that intuition.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. I mean, it sounds a little bit of the, I mean, for me, it's almost, I mean, very different, but almost the same where it's like, you look around, particularly social media is so bad at like reinforcing it. And you're like, what is everyone else doing? Why aren't I doing that? Like, you know what I mean? Like for me, it's like, you know, you're doing an Indiegogo, which everyone should go support. The project is called Joan again. You know, and everyone's like, Christian, do a Kickstarter. Christian, you should do this with you. And I'm like, I gotta actually finish the thing first. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and then
yeah, yeah,
I don't know that I have the mental stability to, like, you know what I mean? It's like yeah. my day job is like very in it. Like it's a production yeah. job. Like, you know what I mean? It's yeah. like, I can't take my eyes off the ball. So like, it's like, you know yeah. what I mean? There's all this, yeah. I understand, like when you're saying like other people like saying you should be doing this, and it's like, yeah, I would love to, like, so yeah, I kind of get where you're going, but you know what? I mean, I am so glad for you, and I am so glad for your project, and I'm so glad that like we reconnected and stuff, because I mean, I just, I remember really enjoying your company and being, and thinking to myself, like, I hope I stay friends with that guy. Like, I hope that we stay in touch. And obviously that didn't happen through the years. Different things occur and people drift in yeah. different ways, but I'm like happy to chat with you again, Stephen, you, and, you know, congratulations on funding on Indiegogo, and everyone should throw their francs, or their euros or their dollars at Joan. Cause I mean, I really enjoyed it, man. I mean, I'm not, you know, I thought this was great, and I love this, the different style, and your influences are stuff that I love and embrace. So, you know, congratulations on all that.
Oh, thanks, dude. I appreciate it. I appreciate it so much.
Where can people find you online? Like, where can people like discover your stuff and, you know, look, do you have, are you, what social media are you on? Do you have a website?
Yeah, so two things, two channels to find me on. Number one's my Instagram. It's SYU artist. So S like Sam, and YU artist. Nice. And my website, sydstudiopresents.com. So sydstudiopresents.com.
Nice. Awesome. Awesome. Well, Stephen Yu, thank you so much for your time. I mean, I really appreciate it.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. This was fun.
Yeah, everyone go to Indiegogo and support Joan, J-O-A-N, like Joan of Arc. And yeah, just throw it some money, because I mean, it's definitely a project that's worthy of it. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoy Stephen Yu. Thank you so much. My name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out at parttimefanboy.com. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. I will actually be at the San Diego Comic-Con this coming week. I will be doing a panel called So You Want to Start a Podcast, Thursday, July 25th, 11 a.m. at the San Diego Central Library. You can find me there along with a couple of other podcasters. I have a small webcomic called The Periwinkle Puss, periwinklepuss.com. It's a hobby comic. Don't judge it too harshly. Again, this has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Please go to Indiegogo and support Joan. Stephen Yu's work deserves it. Thank you so much for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye. Part-Time Fanboy.